growth requires more than capital.
Why do we call it the cheat code? Nobody said growth had to be fair.
Revenue solves everything.
Welcome to the cheat code. What was our fastest path to revenue?
We tend to like to do things the hard way.
What's the cheat code? It's giving yourself an unfair advantage over the others.
What is it that really works, and how are we going to grow these organizations?
That's our cheat code.
Hey, hello, welcome. You are back on The Cheat Code, joined again my illustrious co-host, Mr. Josh Wagner. Josh, great
what
to see
up?
You.
Like, you as
like
well?
We see each other every day.
You didn't come into the office today, so.
That's true. I had a lovely dentist appointment lost. This morning. That's the way I love to kick my day off, you know, someone probing around in my mouth. So we'll probe around with someone else here. So we've got another great guest on the show, joined today by Blake Williams. Blake has a plethora of roles. If you check out his LinkedIn, it's a veritable what's what and who's who within go-to-market partnerships specifically. He's currently the founder and CMO over at Growth Story and a go-to-market advisor to a number of different organizations that, again, if you check out, you'll recognize a lot of these names. Amfactor, Crossbeam, you know, again, huge partner focus, which is what makes him a great guest for the show. And so, Blake, welcome.
Thanks for having me, man. Appreciate it.
Absolutely.
Blake, good to have you.
So we'll kind of hop right in as we always do. You know, the show is the cheat code. And of course, this season's focus is all about partnerships within go-to-market, really driving value through relationships, which has become a monster focus kind of within the space. I was actually just, you know, working with a portco of ours this morning. And, you know, there's so much focus and kind of, you know, content and just, you know, social narrative being put on partnerships and ecosystems. There, you know, you should be doing it. And then there's not a lot of, you know, how do you actually go about doing so? And so, you know, I think you'll have a great perspective and take on that. But squarely, what has been your cheat code within partnerships?
Within partnerships, it's really putting the partner go-to-market architecture underneath the partner program design, and then kind of segmenting the reasons or the jobs that we want our partnerships to do or fulfill in our customer journey and in our pipeline, right? So being able to tie those two things back and then making sure that we can establish kind of that reciprocal value exchange. It doesn't always need to be reciprocal, but trying to make sure that it's there for our partners.
Yeah. So I guess, you know, basically like know what you're trying to do, right? Which is strangely a gap in a lot of ways that folks think about partnerships, and one that's pretty acute, certainly within early stage where we do a lot of dealing. I guess, give me some backstory on that. You know what I mean? Like, although it seems like something that's kind of a no-brainer, like I mentioned, it tends not to be. And so I'm curious to what your experience has been.
Yeah. So over the past 5 years, I've, you know, been running ABM campaigns with partnerships in B2B, specifically to help teams sell tall, deep, and wide. All of these partnerships could be the size of a $71 billion company, $400 million company, or a net new $3 million startup trying to figure out how to go indirect. And the problem is always the same. You can have a partnership program that's got a ton of great brands in it, but you're not extracting the value back out of that partnership programmatically. A lot of things happen in an ad hoc fashion, very opportunistic, which sounds good. The relationship is strong and everybody's friends, but we're not, you know, attaching that business value and returning that revenue back to the business in a way. It doesn't need to be predictable, but it does need to have a pattern and a process that your internal functions can capitalize on. You know, and that activation component is, you know, we can enable to until we're blue in the face and get everybody certified, all those things. But it really comes down to grabbing those audiences and then attaching our go-to-market in some form or fashion along different levels of commitment so that our marketing, sales, customer success, and RevOps teams know what they're doing and the plays that they're going to run to really bring that value back.
In your cheat code, I heard you mention the words architecture and design, and it sounded like they are layered together in some function. Can you give some examples of both and how they fit with one another?
Absolutely. So when we think about architecture, you know, we might be talking about, well, we are talking about the people, technology, the processes, right? And then the training around what to do. If a lot of your team hasn't been up the mountain before, then you've got to serve it up, mashed peas and carrots. You know what I mean? You can't just say, hey, we've got a partner. You should ask for intros. Well, what's that look like for an AE who's busy doing their entire day job? You know, if you're a bricklayer, which is what these AEs are, right? Not to classify it as anything, but they're doing one thing. They're doing their job in a specific way. And if you think of them as craftsmen, you're coming in and asking them to adopt a 3D printer. And they're like, well, no, we lay bricks and none of our processes, none of my things that I do to get deal flow are, you know, catered to that. They're not set up for it, right? So there's a change management that needs to occur. So when it comes back to those people, processes, and that kind of thing, programmatically, how are you establishing the different levels of commitment of the types of campaigns that you're going to engage other partners on to let them hand raise and say, look, we want to do a joint led, or we want a partner led unsupported, or we want you to lead this and we're not going to show up in any way, shape or form, but we'll give you access to the data, right? Having that clear along every single partnership allows you to identify what value and what's the value worth to your business if you were to invest in executing all those activities. It might be 4 webinars a month. It might be 2 in-person activities. It might be a mailer, but all these things should be figured out programmatically and not, you know, the partnership leader sitting down trying to discover demand gen for the first time and then be an expert at it. You know what I mean?
Yeah. We just ran into this the other day as well. And like, this gets back to like, again, something that is so fundamental that you said that folks hop over that I want to call attention to, which is just, you know, okay, so you've got a partner and, you know, again, to your point, like this oftentimes is, yeah, all right, who's the biggest player in my space? You know, those billion-dollar organizations. And, you know, if we partner with them, it's going to add validity to who we are, what we're doing. People are going to fall over themselves to buy our solution. And when you make that assumption and then you try to force that assumption down within an organization, it leads to a ton of wheel spinning. So this particular example, like I won't give away the organization, but the partner was NVIDIA, and you know, so like massive organization, technology provider, super hot right now, and you know, they have an innovation program. They allow you to use their SDK and their APIs to build on top, and of course, that's gonna, you know, for them lead to more business. Like it's a pretty clear technology-led growth strategy for them. Now at the partner level, however, they're making a ton of assumptions around this. And so like calling them back to, you know, have we aligned with them around the fact that we are going to go to market together, or are they just providing you, you know, really a sandbox to play in, to build on top of their technology and, you know, widen their footprint within the marketplace. And those conversations had not happened. Right. And so even at that fundamental level, you've got to have just an ultra amount of clarity. Because then to your second point, like then there's going to be some really tactical stuff that comes out of that clarity. Yes, we are going to co-sell and here's the teams involved. Let's align those folks. Here's how we're going to enable them. And here's the actual motions that we're going to go through. Because just trying to flip it over the fence and say like, oh, we've got this great product that's built together. And now at this point, like go work with their sellers and sell it. Like that is squarely the point where partnerships die.
That's it. That's it. 100%. And I think just to you know, make more concise, what you are getting at is that if you're not attaching yourself to your partner's customer journey in some official way, shape, or form that gets sellers excited to introduce you at some point in the funnel, then the chances that it's going to happen in a way that you can build a business around is probably not very solid. Right. It's just sellers have one thing on their mind. It's closing business, retiring quota. And if your customer is not going to get excited and it's not a formal step in the process about me introducing that partner, then, you know, it'll be whenever it happens, you know, whenever it feels good versus
or maybe never
something or maybe never. Right. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Well, if I may add to your analogy there, I've been the bricklayer. Right. And I'm specifically remembering back literally my first day working for Justin 10, 12 years ago. He, you know, pops over to my cube and he says, hey man, I got a lead. Why don't you just jump on this call with me? I'm like, all right, cool. Sounds great. So we go into the conference room, we hop on a call. I'm just a fly on the wall. Justin's kind of going through the whole deal and we hang up. And he says, all right, you've got it from here. What are you going to do next? I said, well, you know, I'll get my follow-up together and this and that. And he goes, wrong. What do you mean wrong? Right. He goes, you call Marketo right now. You find out who the rep is who would cover this. Find out if they've talked to him. See what the, like, that was our biggest partner at our firm organization. And it was just from day one, call one. Your first thing is to call the partner and figure out what's going on. It's not do your follow-up and you know, devise a plan on your own and all that kind of stuff. And that's if it's not ingrained from that early of a moment, it might never get ingrained.
That's it. Yeah. And I tell people, you know, the partnership leaders that I work with, I consult with them. They're like, I want to get myself out of the AE BDR role. And I'm like, you know, we can have that as an objective, but you need to show these people. It's like, you know, doing surgery, a medical students, they see shadow then do, right? Mm-hmm. You should use that same process and show them how to develop a mutual action plan between partners on what you're going to do with an account. Understand what qualification means to each other and what those triggers are. So you know when to pick up that phone and what's live action and what's a waste of my time. Totally. Not that it always has to be that way, but for sure, there should be some structure around that.
Yeah, and I think there's a lot of lessons in there in helping folks diffuse ego, for lack of a better term. You know, because especially if you're getting two sellers, you know, together, which happens a lot of times. And being able to know, like, when you should hit the gas and when they should press the brakes and vice versa. And that takes some just trust building and relationship building and whatnot. But it also takes leadership to say, this is how you engage these folks. This is what I want you to find out. Find out what's in it for them. Why should they care? What do their customers care about? Like, it can't just be, hey, I've got this shit. Go sell it with me, for me. You know, whatever it may be.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think it's, you know, one of the bigger things is, like, I try to teach when I'm talking to AEs that, you know, if you put $10 in, you can take $5 out. But if you're putting nothing in, you're not going to get anything back. So you got to make deposits into these communities. If you want them to be rich for you, you got to be rich to them. You know what I mean? Yeah. And first mover advantage, the first person who starts sprinkling around leads to the other partners, you're going to get all kinds of love, you know, and you can build. Go ahead.
That give to get mentality, and even the mentality, Josh, that you were talking about, like, is, I think we have to recognize, like, how foreign that is to, you know, pretty much everyone, right? Like, I was on a pipeline call the other day, and we were working through something very similar to what Josh described, like, hey, you know, Portco, like, all right, this is what you're showing me as a forecast. Like, we're obviously there as a board member and investor, but, like, what have you engaged, you know, from a relationship standpoint here? Like, how are we using the ecosystem? And it was just striking to me how the first reaction was like, well, they're not super happy with, you know, the partner that I was suggesting that they bring in. I think that actually is going to hurt us in this deal cycle. It's like, whoa, like, you just stumbled upon someone who is, like, upset and potential churn risk for a partner that you're trying to develop. Like, that's gold to them. Like, that's the reason why you should want to reach out immediately. Like, back to that give to get mentality. Like, hey, just want to let you know, here's someone that's unhappy. Here's exactly why they're unhappy. By the way, I think we can solve some of these fundamental pains. You know, would recommend that you do this on your side. Like, let's develop an action plan around this. That's just such, you know, great fodder for relationship building at, yes, the organization level, but also at a level where, like, someone's job is to retain this customer, and, like, they're going to be judged on that this month, right? And so, that's like, you're giving them a distinct benefit that I don't know if they could get that perspective somewhere else.
Right. Until it's too late. Right. Unfortunately. And I think, you know, I think one of the best things about having partners is that, especially from a seller standpoint, you know, being a principal-led sales organization, is that you have your talk track and the way that you like to sell, and other sellers have a different methodology and present information in a completely different way. So in a way, you get twice as many conversations with the prospect, and you can apply pressure. I mean, it's just you might equate it to being multi-threaded with that direct contact, but it's like, the value is immeasurable, right? The deals are so much easier to close that way.
It's crazy to say that.
Great information.
Yeah. If you get good at that co-selling with some partner sellers, man, you can be strategic. Like, just personality level. Like, listen, I may not be the best fit personality-wise for this prospect. Why don't you lead here? I'm going to go do this thing. You know, take that off of your plate. You go do this. Or, you know, you can switch it up. I had about, I don't know, half a dozen folks at Marketo, like, got really good with that. Like, yeah, we knew when I was going to lead, they were going to lead. We're going to do calls together. We're going to do calls separate. We're going to come back together. And yeah, like you said, it was a slow down to speed up type of thing. And it was gold.
Yeah. It's just like rugby, you know, like you don't want to play with too big of a team, but if you hit a defender, you want to be able to pass it off real quick and keep moving, you know, and cover ground. Going back to that architecture and the trust building is, if you put this in place at the programmatic level for your teams, then when these AEs show up, they're like, yep, I've got a template for mutual action plans. Here's the process I'm going to go through. That doesn't build trust, but it's trust triggering, right? Mm. If I know that you've approached a situation with a certain amount of preparedness and professionalism, then my comfort level for bringing you in before that trust will be higher than just, hey, I'm here to sell a deal with you.
Right.
You know, yeah. That type of thing.
And instills confidence.
They come across. That's it. Yes. Yes, yes, yes.
Like, where have you seen, do you have an example on where you've seen this, like, work out really well? You know what I mean? Like, from a, like you mentioned shadowing and just kind of providing that example, right? Like, and you don't have to name names if you don't want to, but, like, just curious, always looking to kind of provide those same types of examples to our listeners.
Yeah. So, we're working right now with an SI and a big company, Stripe. And part of their training methodology, the SI is usually pulling in multiple pieces of technology to create a unique joint value proposition or solution that they can offer to a particular vertical. And where we saw this, like I was just talking about, that leader who wanted to get themselves out of that AE role, the fastest way to do that was to do the see, shadow, do process. And that AE was kicking the partner leader out of the process as fast as she could. As soon as she got it, she was like, let me just take this over. Mm-hmm. Now, granted, the way that we start these programs is that we don't let just any old seller in. We usually start at the president's club type of thing, folks who already know what they're doing and bring them in. But it works really, really well. And I think in 10 weeks, the number is going to be just ungodly. So it's kind of an outlier, but it was a $9 million deal. And because Stripe was bringing them in, it closed in about 9 weeks, right? 10 and a half weeks to paper or something like that.
Yeah.
But they got agreement in 9 weeks, which is insanely fast.
Well, that's also a really important point there, like in terms of getting back to like where to start. Like, so critical that you start with like those high performers and folks that are going to be, probably more pragmatic and are open to, you know, and also the skill set to be consultative, right? Like to successfully run, I believe, like a really good partner led or partner enabled selling process, marketing process, whatever. Like you have to be able to be consultative in that process and look at find the real problem, not just the pain. And you mentioned SIs, which I think like SIs are such great partners in that regard because they naturally up level things. Strangely, that's the inverse to what a lot of software sellers have thought in the past. Like, I'm not bringing them in. They're going to slow down my deal. They're going to, but like those pains are there whether you uncover them or not. Right. And so like there's a massive amount of risk in just trying to sweep that stuff under the rug for the purposes of getting a deal. But like starting with like that, it could be one individual. It could be like a small, like proof of concept team and so on. And then really showing them like your peer who, by the way, is, as you said, in President's Club circle, whatever, every single year, they're on the beach. You want to be in that same category. Like, this is how they're winning. And, learn from them. Like, this is the distinct process they went through. So I think that's critical.
That's it. And if you want to take that that kind of codification of those playbooks, GA, general audience, with the rest of the AEs, then starting at the top, creating that proof point, now has something that, folks can model themselves after. I know they're already trying to do and leverage the same tips and tricks that the folks who are retiring the most quota are already doing. So it's a great way to drive change management, like kind of having that champion with experience already in place.
For sure.
So Blake, when we talk to a lot of folks, and including even on this show, when we talk about partnerships, people naturally gravitate towards maybe channel or tech ecosystems or a lot of those other things. And you went straight to, the co-selling, like AE to AE or AE to CS. And not a lot of people do that naturally. So that's a tough partnership to identify, I feel like, when that's going to work. What's your secret sauce for kind of figuring out someone's actually a good partner for this type of partnership activity?
Yeah, on the very front end, when we start talking about tying your ICP to an ideal partner profile, again, we're creating multiple ideal partner profiles for sometimes even the function, like you're saying, it's a sales-specific partner that we want to be able to exchange intro, intel, and influence with. What we have to do is move past the ideal partner profile and even deeper into personas and then the jobs to be done down to the contact level so that we know that if any information is going to come from that partner or to that partner, it's specifically around their deal, right? When we think about contact mapping and finding out account mapping and finding out other partners also in that account, it's very surface level directional stuff. It's Kentucky windage. And if you don't drive it down to say, we need to know who is the decision maker in these types of accounts, and is that the same person that we sell to? If it's outside of the function, Cheryl doesn't know John, Cheryl in finance doesn't know John in HR or in marketing. So like that relationship, that account mapping is almost useless.
Yep.
Right. It's good directionally, maybe to target awareness, but you're not going to get the rest of the value that you want out of that.
So when you're identifying these partners, where do you typically get the stop sign from the potential partner? Like, oh, you're going too deep. You're getting too far under the hood for me. This is uncomfortable.
You know, I think if you put enough effort into describing the Better Together story and being clear about the customer pain that you think you're going to solve for that partner, and if you're not solving a customer pain, you might as well just skip the partnership unless there's another value. Seriously.
For sure.
Let it be something that gets you brand awareness or something like that, but don't count on it solving a problem in your pipeline. You know what I mean? And if you can't get down to that level, you're just wasting time and you're going to get, okay, this is a good partnership. We can sign the contract and then, well, let's touch base every now and again, versus this solves a pain point. They're grabbing you by the shirt, running you to the CRO and saying, hey, here's what they can do for us. If you don't have that kind of problem, should you skip the partnership? You know what I mean? Yeah. Again, what's the job of the partnership going to do for your business and for your pipeline? Go ahead.
I was going to say one of the little cheats that we did, we were a scrappy startup that ran a services organization. So, you can be opportunistic for lack of a better word. But we would go to the sellers and we would find out what their top 3 to 5 objections they were getting in their sales cycle. And then we would go back and almost rebrand our services, we call them service packs. Like we'd rebrand our service packs to be objection handlers. And then we would take those back to their sales team and kind of pressure test it a little bit. And like, okay, now when you hear this, you call. When you hear this, you call. And it was like this little objection handling mode. And that was a sweet little deal when we were doing very specific Marketo services.
Yeah, I love, so the agencies have that flexibility. If you have enough service bench, like I'm doing one right now and their partner type is like a Zoom Info type where they're running across SDR teams or people who want Zoom Info but don't have SDRs. Like if they hear that trigger word, that Better Together story assets should be there. The tie from the AE to the AE should be there and it just kicks off like fire. But yeah, focusing on those objections and those pain points, that'll really get you involved.
Yeah, and then shout out to something that you said briefly there with the jobs to be done framework. We actually had someone from our operating partner network come in and kind of run like a mini workshop with one of our portcos specifically around that because they talk in it. Like if anyone listening is not familiar with it, definitely just Google it. There's a million resources on it. But like long story short, like what, in customer language, how do they talk about what they actually have to do? And then obviously that should be the fodder for how you design your solutions, how you speak to them, how you present your messaging, so on and so forth. But it was just funny within that exercise because, immediately everyone starts like answering, this is what I think they would be. And it's like, well, guys, like, that's great. That's our input. But like, now we're going to bring in partners and figure out what their perspective on this is, right? Like, and that's just another, there's not a single facet where having, another set or sets of eyes and ears, who to your point, sell to those same buyers, experience the same pains that they're going through to design that offering with just like it, a hack for market research really is just massively impactful.
Absolutely. And that's the, So when we think about the persona and every VP, right, who we want to make a decision on the solutions that we sell through partners, owns an entire work stream. That work stream is filled with tech, and that tech has points of friction between them, right? Ideally, or the tech and services. So the job to be done, we have to understand the job to be done for that persona, where those points of friction are, and our partners fill in the gaps and spaces to our left and right.
Yep.
So that makes your orbit for that persona. If you sell to three personas, you need to have three different orbits with three different jobs to be done with better together stories that articulate the value that they're going to extract out of that. And that's where I see, like, you see the Sixth Sense and Sales Loft and the Mutiny partnerships and all of those things. They work so well because they're attached to the ABM workflow that an ABM person owns that demand gen may report up to. You know what I mean?
Yep.
Yeah. You've brought up the stories a couple times. And I think being able to have the stories in your hip pocket to surface up at any given time is a super powerful tool, partnerships or otherwise. What have you seen as the best way to get that repository together? How do you package them up? How do you train AEs on them? How do you, you know, the whole kit and caboodle? Because it can be a big thing to wrestle with.
Absolutely, it is. And again, the architecture, right? How do you develop a joint value proposition, right, for that specific persona? And then what are the standardized ways that you're going to productize that better together story or that JVP in Better Together Story assets? One pagers, landing page, a blog article, the, you know, spinning GIF or whatever it is to announce your partnership. Having that standardized makes it very, very easy and less of a lift if it's like, oh, this is a brand new partnership and now we got to figure everything out again, you know, versus having that standardized. But yeah, I would say one of the things we're working on at Growth Story is that we build that joint value proposition knowledge base. Shameless pitch.
Now, I was going to actually ask you about that because I think that's it's an approach that I've not heard a lot of people taking. And like when you think about like partner technology, everyone thinks about like exchanging lists. So like, yeah, talk a little bit more about that because I do think like the approach that you guys are taking there is super interesting.
Yeah. So ultimately, you'll come into Growth Story, you drop in your URL, your partner's URL, and then Growth Story facilitates you through that process of how to develop a joint value proposition. And you don't necessarily need to know anything to be able to answer the questions as long as you know like the firmographics around the account you're going after, the titles and the types of other software that your buyer might buy. And then, you know, what's their current state? What limitations do they run into? What's the unified better together story? What's the problem that it solves? And then it spits out your JVP into a blurb. And then from that blurb, we basically take it and we develop a fully coded HTML, JavaScript, CSS landing page with all the better together content on it, focused for that one persona. So it's done in about 12 minutes. So if you wanted to do five different personas or, you know, five different types of companies, you might spend 45 minutes getting that done. It also builds like the outreach sequences. If you wanted to write an article, it'll do that for you, SEO enabled. And you basically end up with this payload that it only takes you really 45 minutes to fully enable a brand new partnership that's conversion ready and launchable at links.
Wow.
With an asset that is normally completely overlooked within this process. Like,
right.
I know we're kind of throwing around like value prop and like better together message. Like it's a buzzword, but like it's so critical and fundamental to like, again, why are we doing this? Like what, you know, what's the value to the buyer? What's the value to the partner and even the, you know, partner, you know, field folks that we're trying to co-sell with or, you know, go to market with that aspect. Absolutely. If you ask most sellers, it's like, well, you know, we've got this great integration between, you know, platform A and platform B. And it's like, well, yeah, but what does that do? Like, what is that job to be done or that critical pain? How do we solve for it? Right. What's the value prop, right? Like that tends to be just something that is, you know, completely glossed over.
Yeah, it's, you know, the fact remains that 100% of people can't convert on assets that don't exist, right? And so unless you plan on growing your business word of mouth indefinitely, right? Not even capitalizing on all of your partnerships. Like you may have 150 partnerships, 10 are strategic. Those 10 get assets. Everybody else is left flailing in the wind doing random acts of partnership, right? But if you enable them with the right payload, then you absolutely increase the opportunity for people to start to convert. And better yet, if you put up the architecture for those standard plans to go into play, then you start to spin up your flywheel in a way that really helps you scale.
For sure.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I remember the early days of the binder, right? Like every partner submit your one sheeter with your top story and we'll put it in the binder. We'll distribute the binder. Who's using this thing?
Who's using this binder? Right? No one.
This just seems like work for work snake. But this sounds like a cool way to get people to adopt and activate in the field in a relatively short order. I think it's the adaptability of it that is super interesting to me because you might do the binder thing, even if it's a digital binder. Those things never get refreshed. They never get added to. They never, you know what I mean? And I think the way you're talking about it, having some generative large language models and using sites to kind of be able to continually update and refresh will help activate the field a lot better.
That's absolutely it. And, you know, you might as well replace the word binder with PRM. Sorry, PRMs. But there's already a bunch of content that's meant for everybody and, you know, converts on almost nobody in those in those platforms. You know what I mean? They're not specific for the actual target. And there's such a distinct difference between, you know, partner program management and design and, you know, measurement and then the actual demand gen and partner go-to-market underneath it. And a lot of people conflate the two or they just bucket it in and just say, hey, partnership leader, go be great at partnerships and also learn demand gen. And that's somebody else's whole job. You know what I mean? It's not a passerby thing because it's actually how the business extracts the value and returns it back in revenue.
Yeah, totally makes sense. So, I mean, like we've kind of hinted at some of this already, but I always love to ask the question, like what's your worst partnership horror story? Having talked about all these, you know, great assets that obviously solve for a lot of what we've experienced, but is there a horror story that sticks out?
Yeah. And it unfortunately doesn't have to do with assets, but it has to do with the co-selling process where a partner identified an opportunity and they brought me in and then the customer decided not to move forward with their services or software and they moved forward with me. And it was like a year long deal. It was a couple $100,000 and that was our first deal together. And so when we start thinking about trust building, it's like, And I didn't steal it away. They just shrunk the budget and then reallocated it. It was like forces out of my controls. But that was a horror story for me because it was a relationship first.
Relationship, yeah.
And then we both try to go to market and it's like, I can give you referral fees out of this. No thanks.
I've seen that go even the worst way where, you know, you bring in a partner and that partner tries to replace you with someone else within their stable. Like it's always a difficult, kind of shell game there and so on. And like, I think the macro point here, like the relationship has to be strong and aligned and stable before you get into those areas or some really wonky stuff can certainly take place.
Can go. Yes. So that's it. That's my horror story.
sounds familiar, unfortunately.
Yep.
Right.
So I'm curious because you're kind of in the forefront of partnership go to market from the technology perspective. Are there items areas out there like trends, even products, so on and so forth that like really excite you today that you're looking at that's like, hey, that's going to be the next big thing?
Yeah, I like next big thing. I don't think any of us can. It's probably too early to tell what the next big thing is. You know, I think. PRMs have a lot of evolution to do. Superglue, I think, is awesome. Rob's company, they're doing a lot around automation. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, a couple pieces are coming together to build this full architecture that is required for the whole thing to actually work. I think what Greg Portnoy is doing with Euler is pretty awesome. I like where he's focusing, trying to be that next generation, not PRM, but another version of it or something like that. But yeah, there's a lot of cool things going on out there.
Yeah, it's funny to see how, you know, swiftly kind of this iteration cycle has moved around partnership. Obviously PRMs have been around forever, but I feel like the focus on like partner ecosystem or like nearbound or whatever we want to call it it's really only been around for like 3 or 4 years now at this point. And it's almost like that first iteration was definitely like kind of the list exchange and so on. And now we're seeing like, you know, cycles and iterations even within that compressed amount of time. I feel like if you applied that to like marketing automation, that took like a solid decade for like the first V1 and then, you know, different, kind of like augmentation elements to be born and so on. Like, I guess it just applies to all technology these days, but like partnerships is definitely moving at a pretty swift clip at this point.
I always kind of feel like benchmark the success of a function by how many CEOs come out of that function. So historically it was always finance, right? Like CEOs came up through finance and that was what it was. And then that started to really dovetail into ops. Like the big operators were becoming CEOs, and then sales, you know, coming through sales, CRO, they become CEOs. And we were like, when's marketing going to become a CEO? Is that ever going to happen? Right. And it started to, right? When we were in the heyday of marketing automation and tech and everything, marketers started becoming CEOs. Do we think we'll see a CEO come out of the partnership function?
Yeah, I think it depends on how that company grows up. I think it'll get there for sure, especially with like those macro elements like we had, 2008, that's really macro. Then the pandemic and now growth at all costs is kind of out the door for, capital efficient growth. That kind of pressure will definitely breed, you know, more chief partnership officers who will probably make that lateral move or upward move to a CEO.
First, we just need to see more of those folks out there. I still don't see a lot of chief partnership officer, but I think it's getting there. You know, like as this starts to integrate and become, you know, truly a top-down edict, those are some of the dominoes to fall, certainly.
Absolutely. Well, and, you know, this may be a controversial opinion, but I feel like if a business moves fast enough, you may not need a chief partnership officer, right? In terms of your ability to incorporate partnerships into your currently or existing functions, there may not be a need because you've got everyone in the function who's already a C-level person.
I think that's, you know, the question is like how well does this notion of relationship-led growth and partner-led growth like really integrate into the core functions of a business? Because that's really what we're talking about, right? Like it has to be top-down. It has to be integrated into every department and function of the business. And to that point, right? Like now you're just refocusing what has been a huge technology focus for, you know, two decades into can be enabled by technology, but fundamentally, like we've got to pursue these relationships and make those central to our business.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So Blake, as we're wrapping up here, like where can folks connect with you? Where can they check out, you know, stuff that you got going on with Growth Story, and just how would you rather they connect?
Yeah. You can connect with me on LinkedIn. You can check out the website. I'm launching a podcast of my own called Underrated Podcast with Katie Lambert from HubSpot. So should be doing our first couple of shows in the next few weeks. But yeah, other than that, on LinkedIn or at any of these events that are coming up.
Sweet. What's the next event you're going to?
ELG down in Austin.
Very cool. Yep. All right, man. Thanks so much for joining us on the show. Obviously, if you guys are just tuning in for the first time, you're lucky. It was a great show with Blake, but please give us a follow on whatever platform because we're literally on all of them. Really helps us out. Check out Blake and Growth Story, certainly. Blake, it's been awesome having you on the show. Super insightful. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Absolutely. And for Mr. Wagner and myself, thanks for tuning in to another episode of The Cheat Code. We'll see you next week. Growth requires more than capital.
Why do we call it the cheat code? Nobody said growth had to be fair.
Revenue solves everything.
Welcome to The Cheat Code. What was our fastest path to revenue?
We tend to like to do things the hard way.
What's the cheat code? It's giving yourself an unfair advantage over the others.
What is it that really works, and how are we going to grow these organizations?
That's our cheat code.